Good morning. The
Good
next
morning, Leona.
case on the court
Hi,
oral calendar this morning is in Read the Trust of Donald Roy Scheid and June Vivian Scheid, Joint Revocable Trust. We're ready for arguments from counsel, which we'll hear on the Zoom platform. The rules for our appellate hearing this morning are the same. Please be mindful of the timing mechanism up in the left-hand corner of the screen, as well as attempts by the judges to interrupt you with questions. And be sure to state your name for the record before presenting any part of your argument so we have a clear record of who was speaking. With that, we will hear from counsel for, let's see, appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Cometh, and I represent the appellant, Stephen Scheid. The case comes before this court on a motion for summary judgment granted in favor of the respondents. At its heart, this case is about equity. It is about fairness, whether that's upholding the original intent of the settlers, Donald Scheid and June Scheid, with respect to their joint revocable trust, or enforcing the promise that settlers made during their lives to convey the building site to appellant Stephen Scheid.
It seems like this is a case more about simple interpretation of language than about fairness. Is that not so?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe it goes in hand with each other. Because of the district court's order, the original intent of Donald Scheid was not upheld, and that is inequitable. But you are correct. The primary role of this court is to interpret the trust agreement and ascertain the actual intent of both settlers and then give effect to that intent.
Whether we think it's equitable or not.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And those are really the three issues for the court. The first one will be whether or not the trust was subject to amendment after the death of the first settler. Two, whether June Scheid committed a breach of trust when she executed the second and third amendment. And then third, whether the district court erred when it dismissed appellant's promissory estoppel claim with prejudice.
And if you're right on the first issue, we don't get to the second two?
Yes, Your Honor, you are correct. Thank you. As I mentioned, the goal of this court is to interpret the trust agreement. When the language is plain, the language controls, and the court is not allowed to add or substitute words or rewrite the trust document. Now, the trust instrument itself should be read as a whole, with each provision interpreted harmoniously with the others so that every provision is given some meaning to the extent practicable.
Can I jump you right to what might be considered the heart of the question when it comes to interpretation? And that's, if I'm not mistaken, it's 1.3.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes.
And let me just pause you there for a moment. I'm going to ask you a question and I'll just put it out there quickly so that you can address it if you want to during your argument. And I'd like Mr. White to also address it in his argument. And that is, so this, as I see it, this agreement may be amended or revoked only during our joint lives as follows. And it seems to me it might be interpreted not changing the language, but paraphrasing it to give the potential meaning that it may be amended or revoked only during our joint lives and only as follows. That's one interpretation, I think, looking at the grammar of it. And the other is may be amended or revoked only during our joint lives as follows, which would mean that after the joint lives, there's no restriction at all, that that which follows doesn't apply after the joint lives end. So I guess my question is, do you agree that there is a potential grammatical ambiguity that we would say is legally ambiguous unless the context of the rest of the trust would render, would leave only one reasonable interpretation based upon the substance? Sorry for the long-winded question, but I'm a mirandering thinker this morning.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I believe that Section 1.3 is not legally ambiguous.
No, my question is, do you agree that it's grammatically ambiguous, but it's not legally ambiguous only because of context elsewhere in the trust? Or do you think it's grammatically unambiguous on its face?
Thank you, Your Honor. I do not believe that Section 1.3 is grammatically ambiguous. The only during our joint lives modifies in all respects when that document can be amended. The as follows really further limits and delineates how that power may be exercised and under what circumstances.
But isn't that, again, looking just at the grammar, not any of the substance, that's not the only grammatical interpretation of the sentence, depending on where you imply a comma or whether the and or whether the only modifies only part of what follows. I'm not sure how you get to the point where it's grammatically unambiguous.
Thank you, Your Honor. What I would state to the court is that it doesn't state only during our joint lives, comma, this trust agreement may be amended as follows. The only amended, only during our joint lives as follows modifies the amendment in all respects. So I would still submit to the court that it is grammatically plain, that there is no ambiguity. But assuming that it is grammatically ambiguous, this court is correct.
I mean, just to be clear, the reason why I'm suggesting an ambiguity, it seems just looking at the grammar, one might read it to say that this agreement may be amended or revoked only during our joint lives, as limited by what follows, meaning that if it's not during our joint lives, these limitations don't apply.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that is one interpretation, and it certainly is a reasonable interpretation, but I believe that when you look at Section 1.3, grammatically.
Just so we're clear then, you are agreeing that it is grammatically ambiguous, but if we apply, and your argument would be if we apply the context of the rest of the trust, then the ambiguity is resolved and your interpretation is the only reasonable one.
Yes, Your Honor, I would concede that point. Thank you. So when the court looks at the surrounding circumstances under which this trust was created, it's clear that the settlers intended that this trust would not be subject to amendment after the death of the first spouse. These parties, the settlers, they understood how to grant a power to amend. They understood how to limit that power to amend. And when you look at Section 1.3, in light of paragraph 1.3.1, it shows an intent to limit amendments in all respects to the joint lives of the settlers. They did not say that this trust may be amended by either settler at any time. That would have made sense, and that would have been a clear expression of intent. But as this court knows, and as the record shows, both settlers were in their 90s when this document was executed. They could have done separate estate planning documents. Instead, they chose to do a joint revocable trust with a limitation on the power to amend. It can be inferred then from those circumstances that the parties wanted this to be the final mutual estate plan for the family. And then giving expression and effect to Section 1.3.
But you're asking us, I mean, the age of the parties isn't in the trust agreement. I mean, you're asking us to go outside. It seems like you're saying it's ambiguous and therefore we can go outside of the four corners of the document to infer the meaning. So you seem to be suggesting in that argument that not only is it grammatically ambiguous, but it's also legally ambiguous, requiring us to look elsewhere for the actual meaning. Is that really where you want to take us?
No, Your Honor. I stepped a moment ahead too far in my argument. I apologize. That's if the court does find a legal ambiguity, that would be a way to resolve it. But if we turn to the other sections of the trust, this court will see that every other provision, sections 1.5, sections 2.1, can be construed reasonably and in a manner that allows for section 1.3 to prohibit amendments after the death of the first settler. So section 1.5 provides that the settlers can direct the trustee as to the retention, acquisition, or disposition of assets. Now that power, which is relied in part by respondents to infer this power to amend in Jude Scheid, is really just an administrative power. It allows the settlers to direct the trustee to take an action. It's a management power to ensure that the trustee is managing, investing, and disposing of assets properly. What section 1.5 does not do is give Jude Scheid the power to amend the written page of the document. And likewise,
couldn't June, as the sole settlor and trustee, have gotten all of the property out of the trust and just given it to herself?
Yes,
and
sir.
Then in her will, she could have divided the property any way she wanted to. And that would not, I mean, would that have violated the terms of the trust if she had done that? If she decided for my health, education, and welfare, and that I'm going to distribute everything out of this trust to me personally, and then in my will, I'm going to figure out how to divide it all up.
Thank you, Your Honor. You are correct. That would not have been a violation of the plain language of the trust agreement and the intent of the settlers as demonstrated by that trust language. It may seem like a putting form over substance, but that's what is required here. Sometimes the power to revoke can assume the lesser power to amend. And that's what you would have to infer for section 1.5 or 2.1, in this case, to be a power to amend the written page. The argument is she can distribute everything outright and set up a new trust or distribute the property how she wants. But because we have an express provision here, section 1.3, which states this trust is maybe amended or revoked only during our joint lives, it requires that we put this form over substance and that the plain language is followed to a T. That was their intent when they signed this document, and that's what the trust agreement requires. Thank you. So section 2.1, which I kind of alluded to, is a broad power of distribution. It allows the settlors to compel the trustee to distribute all principal of the trust outright. And to that extent, like we talked about, she could have set up a new trust. But it would be unreasonable to assume that, again, that the settlors wanted June Scheid or expected June Scheid to use that power to amend the trust. That power is designed to give the settler access to the property for needs, for gifting, for even sheer whims. But it does not actually, it should not override section 1.3. It would render that provision meaningless. So moving to the third issue, promissory estoppel, there is a clear and definite promise here, Your Honors. And justice requires that that promise be enforced and that Steve Scheid actually receive the building site regardless of what this trust document states. As testified to by-
But there's a promise here in this trust document, but the settlers could change that at any time, correct? I mean, you're not saying that when both were alive, that they couldn't have revoked it.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, I'm not stating that. With most testamentary dispositions, whether done through a will or through a revocable trust, they don't vest any rights in Stephen Scheid. And certainly they can be changed at the settlor's or testator's whim. And that's just the way the law works for these instruments. However, promissory estoppel is a flexible doctrine. It is designed not as a consideration substitute, but as a means to enforce justice when someone relies on the promise of another. And so Stephen Scheid was promised numerous times during his life. Every time he asked his parents, he would say, "May I make a major improvement to this property?" And they would say, "You go ahead. Someday you're going to inherit this property." Now, the fact that someday is kind of vague doesn't render this promise unclear or unclear. That just reflects the actual understanding. Nobody can predict when they're going to die. But the reason this is a clear and definite promise is because the settlors took actions to actually carry out this promise. They put this promise in their will, the 1993 will of Donald Scheid, and again, in their revocable trust as well. So that shows actions on the part of settlors to make a definite promise, to carry it out, and it makes Mr. Scheid's reliance reasonable. So based on that promise, you know, this is his family home. He's been there for 63 years. And simply, even looking outside the math, although we should look at all the circumstances, he would be robbed of the home he's lived at for 63 years. And again, he put improvements both on that property, the outbuildings, and his parents' house. He would lose access to those, some of those outbuildings and his parents' residence should this promise not be enforced. So thank you, Your Honors. Appellant would respectfully request that the court reverse the district court's rulings as to counts 1 and 2, and enter a summary judgment in favor of the appellant. Alternatively, appellant asserts that there is a tribal issue of fact as to whether or not justice requires this promise to be enforced. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We're ready to hear arguments from the attorney for respondents. Would you please introduce yourself and begin your argument?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kenneth White. I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent the respondents, Gwen Milkey and Mary Kivlin. Your Honors, to jump directly to the areas that this court focused on in terms of the language of this trust, I think it's important for the court to recognize that there is really no legal dispute here. There's no argument about what the law is. Both parties agree that this court must look within the four corners of the document at all of the available language and try to enforce that language in the way it's written. The appellant also does not dispute that the right to dispose of all of the property is the right to revoke, and that the right to revoke leads to the right to amend the trust, that you can, posed in one of the questions, you can simply dispose of all the assets, transfer them out of the trust, and rewrite a new will or rewrite a new trust, and the law allows that. The Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized that, and the Restatement of Trusts recognize it, and there's no dispute about that legal construct. So then we get to the language of this trust within its four corners and how is this court to interpret it. And I would submit to this court that the district court got it exactly correct.
Can you, Mr. White, jump to the question that I posed to opposing counsel and give your answer to it, which is that the language we're talking about, 1.3, I'm just state a proposition, you tell me whether you agree with it or not, is grammatically ambiguous. That is, there are alternative meanings that we might draw from it without, and either of which is reasonable. But your position is that if you look at the context of the law and the context of the rest of the trust agreement, then there's only one reasonable interpretation in substance.
Your Honor, yes, I agree that if you simply take the clause the court read, and try to interpret just that clause, that there is a grammatical ambiguity. However, that's not the role of this court. The role is to interpret the entire trust language and the trust language as follows in section 1.3, resolves any question about that potential grammatical ambiguity.
So I'm looking at Article 1 as a whole, not just at 1.3 and the parts that underlie it. So, I mean, it is interesting the way it's constructed, because every single clause of, you know, 1.1, 1.2, 1.4, 1.5, 1.6, 1.7, all begin with the infinitive framing, to direct, to appoint, to receive, to direct, to add, to make, which is consistent with the preface that except as follows. Reserve the following rights to do this, to do that, to do this, to do that. And then we get to this 1.3 language. So I'm trying to look at it in the context of every one of the other operative clauses. And it seems like if I look only at this section, not at the right to revoke, to remove the trustee removing the all of the assets, I'm looking at just this section, In every one of the other provisions, it seems to me that if they're acted on, both parties would be equally rewarded or injured. So if during their lives, you direct the trustee to sell, purchase, invest, or retain trust assets, well, everybody's going to rise or fall equally with that decision, and all of the other ones too, to receive accounts, to appoint an additional successor, et cetera. But it seems to me that if you allow what the district court allowed here, you would treat 1.3 as just the opposite, as allowing one of the parties to take advantage of the other party after death.
Well, I respectfully disagree with Your Honor. Your Honor, I don't think that interpretation follows. And I begin with the very start of Section 1 or Article 1, which says we have the following powers jointly or individually. If this court's analysis was correct, the "or individually" language would not be necessary.
Well, not, no, hold on. I'm saying if you individually did 1.1 or 1.2 or 1.4, if you did any of those things, or 1.5 or 1.6, it would affect both of the parties the same, whether it's jointly acted upon or individually acted upon, I think, as I read each one of those provisions. Correct me if I'm wrong.
And Your Honor, but I think Section 1.3 gets you to the same result. It affects both parties equally, because you have to look at the subsections of Section 1.3. And the subsections of 1.3 all involve joint activity. Yet the dissolution of marriage may not be considered a joint activity. One party doesn't want it, the other party does. But it results in the resolution of the trust or the assets in the trust by a court action or settlement of the parties that from dissolution. If both parties agree in writing, there's a joint writing, they can modify the terms of the trust. And then the middle section, 1.3.2, allows any individual settlor to pull property out. So when both parties were alive, either one of the parents could have pulled the home property out. In doing that, though, it then creates a joint tenancy. So again, as the court has indicated, it impacts both, but both are protected because now it's a joint tenancy, and that's our most protective, if you will, way to own real estate or any other asset. And so, Your Honor, I think if you analyze Section 1.3 and its subparts, that the settlers are making a very clear statement that this provision for modifying the terms of the trust only applies in those cases where they are both still alive. So the only modifies joint lives, not we can never do it once one of us passes.
But if you could do it once one of us passes, that would mean one of us would be able to essentially change the dynamic that I was talking about before, which is one party gets to benefit over the others.
Well, Your Honor, one party is deceased, so that party doesn't have any interest left. So at that point, there's only one party that remains alive, Ms. Scheid, and she gets, under the terms of this trust, to make a decision about whether or not what she and her husband talked about is ultimately what they want to continue. And I would disagree with counsel who argues that Section 1.5 and the phrase disposition is limited to some kind of administrative power. This court has recognized the exact opposite. In the Anderson decision that this court decided in 2017, and the citation to it is 2017 WL 67951, at page 7, this court was specifically required to define disposition. And in doing so, it said, and I quote, and it cites the Black's Law Dictionary, a disposition is defined as the act of transferring something to another's care or possession, especially by deed or will, the relinquishing of property. And so this court has interpreted disposition, as I think is its natural interpretation, as being much broader than simply making a decision whether to sell or hold on to property or to purchase particular property. Disposition is a broader phrase. And here the settlers gave themselves the opportunity upon the death of one of them to individually change the disposition of property. And that's what the two trust amendments that are at issue here does. The second problem with, major problem with the appellant's argument here, Your Honor, is that, again, it simply ignores the other language contained in the trust. It simply ignores the language of section 2.1 and the authority that that gives to the settlers to direct the trustee to dispose of property and thus the authority to amend under undisputed Minnesota law. And so however you analyze this, whether you look at section one or article one alone, which is a violation of the legal standard we're supposed to apply, or you look at the at section 2.1 alone, or you look at section 7.2 alone, which allows the trustee to dispose of all the property. And there's no health, safety, needs kind of limitation in any of that language. It is simply the right to do so. And if you grant the right to do that under the law, it becomes it is the equivalent of the right to amend the trust, the terms of the trust. And that's what happened here. And this court should thus affirm. If we just briefly look at the promissory estoppel argument, Your Honor, I think there are major flaws in each of the elements, but let me address the two that counsel addressed. First, there is no definite promise. Someday is certainly an indefinite time period. And more significantly, counsel acknowledged at oral argument here that the settlers could have, at any time up to their deaths, have changed the terms. They could have made a decision for whatever reason that it was no longer prudent to give their son the entirety of the building site. Second, Your Honor, counsel argues that it would be inequitable, and I think
if that's so, then son would presumably have an action based upon promissory estoppel at that time.
I don't believe so. First of all, because it's too indefinite a promise.
But right. Second, but I was talking about your alternative argument.
Well, my alternative argument is simply taking counsel's argument and pointing out to this court that that acknowledgement of a change makes this promise that much more indefinite.
Well,
if I can change my mind at any time, it makes the promise that much more indefinite.
But if it's definite, I mean, assuming we disagree with you, assuming that a parent tells a child, someday you're going to be the one to inherit the farm. I guess you're suggesting that that's not definite, that it's not, that's, I mean, it seemed to me, if I heard that, I would think, it's upon my parents' death. Do you think it's indefinite if a parent were to say, when I die, you're going to inherit the farm?
Well, Your Honor, that's, even if you assume that to be a promise, it's not a promise enforceable under Minnesota law. And I don't
know. I'm asking it just on your law, on your argument about definiteness. Is that not a definite promise?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I don't think it's a definite enough promise to be enforceable under the law.
What's indefinite about it? When I die, you're going to inherit the farm.
When I will die, and circumstances change, and we all recognize that you can make a promise, but if the parents had decided that to pay for their needs, they were going to sell the farm, does son now have a claim against the estate because the parents had to sell the farm in order to maintain their lifestyle?
Well, I'm asking only about definiteness. I think if you're talking about the substance of promissory estoppel, perhaps you have a claim. Mom said, I'm going to inherit the farm when I die. I therefore invested $400,000 to enhance the value of the farm. And as soon as I did that, Mom said, I'm no longer going to give it to you. Is that not, I mean, it seems to me that at least there's an argument for promissory estoppel there.
Well,
so I guess I want to focus on the definiteness part, because I'm not convinced that you're correct, and maybe you can convince me.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the court's hypothetical may be sufficiently definite. I haven't thought that through all the way, but certainly the promise here is not. Someday is a really, really ambiguous term. And I think even if it's clear
from context that we're talking about upon death?
Your Honor, I don't think it's clear from context.
No, I'm asking you, even if it were clear from context that we're talking about upon death, is it not a definite enough promise to make it, to have it fall, at least satisfy the definiteness requirement of promissory estoppel?
Your Honor, I don't believe that you can build enough context to establish that is a sufficiently definite promise. But if you could, hypothetically, if you could, which you cannot in this record, but if you hypothetically could, then yes, I suppose you might get into a promissory estoppel argument. But the problem in this case is the last element, obviously, the unfairness element, which the district court correctly resolved, given all of the benefit that the son received over his lifetime, which son seems to ignore. And so, Your Honor, we would simply ask that this court affirm the district court and remand the case for further proceedings within the handling of the trust.
Thank you, counsel. We're ready for rebuttal argument. You'll need to unmute.
Thank you. May it please the court, I have two short arguments on rebuttal. First, respondents argue that Section 1, which provides that settlers may individually and jointly reserve the following rights under Article 1, that general language is followed by much more specific language, and it does not override the specific language in Section 1.3. For example, paragraph 1.3.1 states, this agreement may be amended only by written instrument exercised jointly. To interpret paragraph Section 1 as also making the subsequent paragraph an individual power is simply just inconsistent with the rules of grammar and how we interpret more specific language following general language. Second, in regards to this power to dispose of property, June Shy did not make a disposition of property as would be defined under Black's Law Dictionary, as represented by counsel for respondents. What she did was amend the written page of the document. The trust still owned the property. It was still subject to the rules of the trust and the terms of the trust. There was no actual disposition in any logical sense of that word and how it's defined.
I think his argument, if I'm not mistaken, is that if under all the other rules of law that apply, June could have done exactly the same thing, but using different mechanisms and without violating the trust, that I guess going back to your colloquy with Judge Siegel, the form over substance, I guess you're standing by your position that in this case, form over substance would control. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but maybe you can address that again.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, form over substance does control here. That is the law in the state of Minnesota, as noted in the Schroll case cited in our brief. It's also highlighted by various comments in the restatement. When, if you have an express provision that says you cannot amend the trust, or that you must amend the trust in a certain manner, you have to follow those terms. That's the requirements everyone agreed upon. And so in those circumstances, giving effect to all the terms of the trust, you don't broadly construe section 1.5 or section 2.1. You would then give it a more narrow construction to give effect to paragraph 1.3. I also point out that the court.
So it's your position that kind of no matter what, once Mr. Scheid died, that this trust could never be changed. It could, yes, it could not possibly be amended in any way, no matter what happened, no matter if the son wound up having murdered the father, for example. I mean, I don't mean that seriously, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but no matter what, this could not be amended.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are always various exceptions to those rules that something is not subject to amendment. You can petition the court in if the purpose of the trust can no longer be carried out, if it's economically inconvenient or impractical to carry on this trust, you can amend those trusts in certain circumstances. But those circumstances are not at play in this case. And under the terms of the trust, under the restatements in Minnesota law, we have to give effect to the express restriction on amendment and compel June to set up a new trust. It's also Minnesota law, and this is very important, that unless you reserve expressly a power to amend, you don't have that power, whether it's amendment or revocation. And I would cite Minnesota statute 501c.0602a. That was not cited in our brief, but it does note that unless you expressly reserve the power to amend or revoke a trust, the trust is not subject to revocation or amendment. That's consistent with the common law, and that's the law of Minnesota. And here again, we have that express provision, section 1.3, restricting amendments to the joint lives of the settlors. So again, trying to interpret this trust harmoniously in light of all the powers, we can give construction to 1.3 as a limitation on amendment, while also giving reasonable construction to those other powers. So for all the foregoing reasons, we would request that the court enter summary judgment in favor of appellant on counts 1 and 2. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. That concludes the hearing. Thank you for your arguments on the issues. You'll have a decision within 90 days as required by statute.